Eric, good to see you again, sir.
Good to see you, Martin.
I was fascinated when you first told me about this project because you basically resurrected this brand.
Correct, yes.
So how did that happen and how did you decide to say, you know what, I'm going to do something here?
Well, I always wanted to, you know, build a winery from the ground up. I grew up building things, residential construction to things, all things internet. So creating something from nothing, and I like building things, so why not resurrect and build a winery from the ground up again?
So the pellet name, though, is
very historic.
I was going to say, this isn't a new name in the
It's not your average name.
No.
I mean, Henri Pellet, he was born in Switzerland. He was actually born Henri Pellet, but when he crossed the Mississippi River, he became Henri Pellet. Because he'd be rough and tumble to get out here in California. And he landed here in the Valley in about the 1850s or so. And was second behind Charles Krug, actually being a commercial winemaker here in the Valley. So Krug and Pellet, Henri Pellet, actually worked together in Napa from the very beginnings in 1859, making wine for John Patchett. And then Charles Krug moved to St. Helena in 1861 and started at Krug. And Henri Pellet moved up in 1863 and started Pellet Estate. Mm-hmm.
And so then why did the brand kind of fall by the wayside?
Well, after Henri Pellet's death in 1912, his family just decided to, you know, let the grapes be. And then along came good old Prohibition.
Yeah,
you know, that left fallow lands right there.
Right. And then, that had that impact on quite a few places.
Yes, it did. And then there are some people that came and bought it from the family in 1955, I believe.
Okay.
And then they replanted the grapes there and reestablished a vineyard there, but they were just selling the grapes. And then the current owners bought that in right around 2000 or so, and they were selling grapes as well. And we're a small town of 5,000 people. So I said, let me build a winery.
And what was your goal when you knew about the vineyards, mm-hmm. you knew about the land. What were you after stylistically with regards to, I know that this can come from this land?
Well, I mean, I grew up in St. Louis in the Midwest, so heavily influenced by French Bordeaux. And that was basically all my experience up until when I came out here in 1985 or so. But all the wines that I was drinking from the St. Helena AVA, like Spotswood and Vineyard 29 and Behringer, I mean, they were really, really impressive, I thought. And I quickly learned that on the west side of town there, great grapes come from that kind of property. And so I wanted to try and work with a key winemaker here in the Valley to resurrect the brands and make something of that caliber.
And not just a key winemaker, probably the most famous iconic winemaker in the Valley. So that is a nice feather to pull out or an arrow to pull out of your quiver. But the Chardonnay in particular is unoaked. Why?
Yes. Well, this is styled more like a French Chablis, and it's actually it was a driveway decision, I call it, because we contracted with Sunchase to make barrel fermented Chardonnay, and they showed up with almost double the tonnage that we contracted for that was going to break the bank.
Right.
And I didn't have the oak barrels for it anyway. So we looked at each other and just said, I've got these 75-gallon stainless steel mulers. Let's make a stainless steel unoaked Chardonnay in the style of Chablis versus the barrel fermented version that we were set out to initially make. So we made both.
I love those creative decision making stuff.
Well, it was do or die, otherwise we wouldn't have got the fruit next year.
No, it's a good point. And Sunchase has some amazing fruit.
Yeah.
And so when you say Chablis style, walk us through kind of what that means to you.
Well, to me, that means it's bright, it's crisp, it's refreshing. It's generally single fermentation. But I mean, it's an easygoing wine that's pure Chardonnay. I mean, which will surprise some people because when they drink it, they're like, this doesn't taste like Chardonnay. But I mean, it's with or without food. It's meant to be drunk in its first 5 or 6 years of life.
Okay.
And it's just bright and crisp and nice acid. It's got great mineral balance to it. And versus a barrel fermented style, which has ageability, which is totally a food driven wine.
Right.
You know, you can sit on your porch and watch the world go by with this stuff.
It sounds like a good plan. Yeah. And then the future of the brand, where do you see it in 5 years, 10 years, if you could look into a crystal ball?
If I could look into a crystal ball, I mean, I'd see production probably remaining about the same there, reclaiming some of the Cabernet Vineyard, because we sell half the grapes currently in the Cabernet Vineyard to great winemakers like Dakota Shy and Tom Garrett there.
Yep.
Mike Smith, sold to him since the 2011 vintage or so, and they do absolutely magical things with our fruit, just the way, but in a different style.
Sure.
And that's what's so interesting to compare contrast.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, two different styles, same fruit. It's interesting to see the output. What is production?
Production, how about it's right around 1,000 cases or so between.
Wow. Tiny.
We do like a Henry's Reserve red blend that's always less than 100 cases. Our Cabernet program is probably about 250 to 350 cases, depending on the vintage. About 300 cases of this unoaked Chardonnay and about 250 of a barrel fermented Chardonnay.
And the magical maestro behind making certain that the vineyard speaks into the bottle is who?
Yours truly, Tom Rinaldi.
So Eric mentioned something about classic winemaking styles, specifically Unoaked Chardonnay and a Chablis style. And you've been doing this for quite a bit of time. So what does classic winemaking style mean to you?
You let the fruit speak for itself. We know that that vineyard, Sun Chase Vineyard, is high end, very high quality. And we don't have to play games with secondary fermentations, malolactic fermentations. We don't have to worry about the type of oak we're going to use and the fatness we're going to develop. No, we're going straight for the fruit. And it shows in the wine because it's distinctive. There's been some argument of whether there's minerality can exist in wine because it's not something you can measure scientifically.
Right.
But you pick it up in the flavor. There's a minerality, crushed rock kind of aromatics and then the flavor that's very consistent with the wine that has not been oaked. So we'll get the crispness as well instead of that fatness that you get with the secondary fermentation and with the barrel.
Interesting.
So this is straight fruit and it's bottled early too. So it really doesn't have to develop something or another. It's not going to get oxidized. It's going to be straightforward berries that have been fermented, and that's the beauty of it.
So minimalistic. You don't have to do a lot with it.
Correct.
And I hear that a lot where the winemaker will say, what I have to do is just get out of the way.
And that's the best part of it. Exactly right, too.
But I would imagine with the number of vintages that you have under your belt, is there a challenge when you see something that you know, but then you have to balance that with like, okay, stand back, let it do its thing.
We are very cognizant about the temperature, about the amount of oxidation or not, mm-hmm. and also the cleanliness of the vessels that it goes into. All of those are crucial, but once everything gets into play, it's best to just let it happen. We really are just observers,
right?
More so than doers, if you will.
Stewards.
But we're there to make sure that, you know, it's crucial for temperature, and as the fermentation does occur, there's heat that does develop.
Okay.
So we have to have a way to chill, make sure that it doesn't get above. My crucial temperature for this wine would be in the neighborhood of 80 degrees.
Oh wow.
That sounds like but some red fermentations, we'll let them go in the 90s, and that's just fine and dandy. But that just won't happen with the Sauvignon Blanc and with our Chardonnays.
Well, and this sounds a lot where the science comes into it and the chemistry aspect of it, and then you have the art side of it. So is there something that you draw upon from either inspiration or experience or knowledge or philosophy or training where you say, okay, I see the science part, here's the artistic part, how do you weave that together?
Well, it's already sort of set in stone, if you will.
Okay.
We use a particular clone for the fermented and a particular clone for the non-fermented. So that's a part of the deal that's already set, in,
right.
if you will. It's just for us to basically determine how to clean up the wine.
Okay.
That's crucial because it's going to be cloudy. We don't want to serve a cloudy wine. I don't. So we're going to have to figure the most gentle way of clarifying that wine and making sure that it's presentable and in its pure form.
Pristine. And so that's the Unoaked Chardonnay. The Cabernet is also fairly special. And does Cabernet still sing to you like it does?
Oh, yeah. That's the vineyard itself is situated in just a spectacular area. It's the base of Spring Mountain, so it has wonderful drainage, and that's crucial for Cabernet and Merlot. And the grapes are just, they're just so beautiful. It's just wonderful to go through there and do.
That's an afternoon you look forward to.
Yeah, and the most important part for that, just for aspiring winemakers, if you will, is to make sure that the seed, the pip, is fully lignified. It's turned into wood, so it'll crunch. And it'll be like a sunflower seed, much more than a
right.
You know, some underripe seeds are just not for the game.
No.
And they will present themselves in the wine. If you're not careful, they will show up. And there are things that people think, oh, we better give this 10 more years, but it still won't go away. It's a green tannin that just will not age.
Interesting. So is there anything about the industry that over the years has surprised you?
Well,
I mean, you used to ride up here on a motorcycle and get free tastings and buy $3 bottles.
Yeah. Well, it surprised me, and I guess it's not shocking, is the amount of corporate aspect that has moved into the Napa Valley in particular, but all around the world, if you will. And some of the iconic names are being bought up by corporations, and you hope and pray that they'll keep the same flavor characteristic,
right,
beauty that the families developed in the origins, if you will. So that's been that's something that I went through it. I went through corporate and
survived.
Somehow, but I'm not going back. That's it.
Well, should we crack a bottle?
Let's try it. As a way to open this wine, that's wonderful. With the twist off, the oaked version has a cork, and that's a whole different world. But on this one, we just twist it like that. I like to roll it down my sleeve, and there we are. Rock and roll time. And we don't have to make sure it's pure and clean, because it will be. As long as you keep it in at least a decent storage.
Mm-hmm.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks for having us.
My
outstanding.
Pleasure.